Welcome back to part two of Dialogue Conspiracy. Part two of Dialogue Watergate, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I'd say that people would be getting tired of hearing about the Watergate, but the story's different. Just added on to every week. There's new developments, so it's not really repetitious, I don't think.
It gets more serious every week. This week there was the story of wiring the nation. You see, Taggart was talking about a total police state, the effect we'd have on a total police state. And Congressman Moorhead came across last week, we talked about that emergency contingency unit that James McCord was the head of the, in charge of the radicals, rounding up the radicals. He was in charge of the mail. And he was arrested at the Watergate Hotel. He worked for the government in rounding up the radicals, and he was an employee of the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. So he'd have access to all the lists of radicals. And this week the news came out that the Justice Department gave information to the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. Ehrlichman would send over there for biographies on people's habits or their sex habits and their voting records, and the FBI was giving them to him, and Ehrlichman apologized. He said, I guess that was a mistake for an election campaign to use the FBI, and he was getting information from them. Well, this week, I don't know how many of you saw it, but there was an article on a secret wired nation plan, and that fits in what Lewis Taggart said because it involved the local police and information would come through them. And a gentleman named Edward David Jr., Nixon's science advisor, requested a study in August 71. And Phil, again, this is the fall of 71 when Segretti went to work, Taggart went to work, and Edward David went to work for this, the White House, and the 300-page report that was put together in August 71, every single page was stamped administratively confidential. And this is what the plan was. It was to wire every American home, car, boat with an FM channel into a central communication system under government control. It was worked out by Nixon's domestic counsel. Now remember, in the article I did in The Realist about Roy Ash from Litton Industries, he sits on the domestic counsel of Richard Nixon, and he was a conduit of funds for the overthrow of Greece, for their fascism. And Roy Ash, the domestic counsel, was the one who got this thing worked up. And they envisioned a totally wired nation where, you know, if you have a certain part of your car that has to be on for smog, every television, every radio station, every car, boat, and home would be wired with this particular channel, one or two and later more. And they had a blueprint for a government-operated propaganda and spy system. They called it that. This is in the memo that Congressman Moorhead has. The White House denied it again. They said, I'm sure this administration will not propose something like that. Well, the White House denied that this week. But on television Thursday night, Spiro Agnew was talking on all the channels about being booed and whistled at in San Diego. And he said, we may need new laws for people like this. You see, these people are objecting to the war or to Spiro Agnew, who's never been seen publicly except at military bases. And when he came out publicly, they booed him. So his vengeance isn't to meet the needs of the people or say, what do you want? What is it you want? Let's talk about it. How can we get it? He called them the Nazis, the fascists. He turns it around and says, we need a law to handle you. Now, what that law is, maybe it's called martial law. Maybe that's another Taggart allegation coming out, that he's not going to have people blow whistles at him. He's going to say what he wants, and you're going to listen or go to jail. Well, this plan to bug every home was part of what they called a New Opportunities Program that was put together in Washington last year. And letters would be sent by satellite disseminating social services and alert for disaster. But the important thing was it would provide local police with information they need to combat crime. Crime, by definition, is somebody maybe who doesn't want their home wired. They say you're going to put it in, and you don't do that, so you're breaking the law. That makes you a criminal. Crime will be anybody who doesn't allow themselves to be wired. Like there's a plan to wire people within the Watts area in Los Angeles, these body little computer things. Any person who's been in prison would wear a certain little box around him, and I have articles on that. And these have been tested, too, and it gives him a direction of a radius of 5 miles to go, and outside of that, he has to report where he is and when he comes back. And it's to keep track of prisoners on parole or where they are. And they're wired all the time. You can hear everything they're doing and everyone they're with. And this has been set up down to be tried out in the Los Angeles area. Have you ever seen that thing?
No, I'd like to see... I'd like to see something written about that.
Oh,
I'd like to hear that on the air here. Maybe people would be interested in hearing
that. I'll bring it in next week. These things are in the planning stage. You know, the devices for picking up the tunes, they denied. They said, we had that plan and we scuttled it. But Congressman Moorhead's office said they have the equipment and they've tested it and it works. So the fact that this is just a theory that we're going to use is not true. The deniability of the White House is so unreal, the circumstances that are happening. They, Spiro Agnew, got on television, Meet the Press, last Sunday and denied that all the charges of Dwight Chapin and the White House being involved in the Watergate were just rumors. And Monday, the news came out that they admitted that they had funds in the secret fund and who handled the funds. So the Vice President of the United States gets on and tells you none of this is true, it's hearsay and rumor. And the very next day, the people say, yes, that was the testimony we gave before the grand jury. And the vice president is there telling you everything is all right in the land, and he's simply lying, you know, and you can't trust anyone on this team with their deniability. That what the decision about this particular broadcasting system, it was that it would make use of modern communication techniques in dealing with national problems. You know, they would handle unrest, if there's unemployment and starvation, that becomes a national problem and people get hungry and protest. You eliminate the people that
are
speaking up.
Well, it didn't say they were to deal with starvation that way, did it?
Well, what the people that are protesting, like in Washington this week, are a group of Indians asking for less than starvation share of their thing that's going on. All the treaties were broken. They never got fair housing, education, food to eat, you know, and wildlife and fish being taken away. That's starvation. But given a system where everybody's wired or bugged, they wouldn't meet in Washington again and scream and yell. You just simply remove them back to the starvation level.
Yeah. This wired nation concept is not new. It's been talked about among broadcasters. The government did propose, and to my knowledge, is still considering a system whereby on direction from the White House or from one of the national headquarters, like at Stone Mountain, these special transmitters, government transmitters, would be installed all over the country, and they would be able to go on the air, the government would be able to go on the air through every radio and television station in the country.
And immediately, give orders.
And immediately transmit information, and it would go to every radio and TV set, whether it would be on or not.
Yeah.
It would automatically come on, whether you had the set on or off, and no matter what station you were tuned to, it would come on over that station, and the government would be broadcasting through every receiver in the country, radio and TV.
Well, these
and that has been on the drawing boards for a long time.
See, this is the way they took over Greece when they cut all the communications except certain channels or radio stations. Then they get on the broadcast and they say, every person with a weapon, turn it in. And if you don't do it, you're thrown off to Greek island and tortured and become a prisoner. If it's broadcast through every station that you turn in your gun, you either do or you don't. And everyone march out in front of the houses, and these people will go this place, and like in Germany, others will go there, and you'll be shipped off on trains. All of this is possible because if they own the communications and they give the orders, anything that you fight back, you become a criminal because the order comes down from the state. You know, the important thing is the connection to the police units. This is what Tackwood was talking about, and I think 1 or 2 years from now people are going to be sorry that they didn't take those allegations seriously and didn't write to congressmen and while his Watergate thing is being opened up, didn't show any interest in what's happening.
We've strayed from the Watergate. Let's return. You have a lot of material still there.
Well, here's a McGovern Shriver newspaper which has an address here. And it has the dates of keeping up with the Watergate, because on this show, we could just barely cover 1 or 2 articles, and I wanted to use the funding, how it pertained to the Tackwood and the provocateurs that were hired, and the police state that Tackwood talked about, the whole national broadcasting thing, so we can't cover all the articles, but this little newspaper has a resume of the news from September 21st. It's a three-page article, two pages and a half. It comes from the Govan Shriver headquarters on Memorandum on the Watergate. And the address is 1910 K Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20006. And you can pick it up, this little newspaper. This one is dated October the 24th. And there's the first one that came out, September 21st, and then the next one is October 24th. And they have these mimeograph pages with a resume of what has been happening, so that if people want to become more informed, write and get this information. There's not even a prize on it. And
write to Dave Reinhardt.
There's no reason not to be informed on this, you know? Give the address again, and you'll get the McGovern Strider newspaper.
It's actually, I think, a news release. It details the whole, it's a chronology of the Watergate affair from those dates that May mentioned. And write to Dave Reinhardt, R-E-I-N-H-A-R-T, 1910 K Street, Northwest, 1910 K Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20006.
Now, you know, in my first article in The Realist on the CIA operation, how the CIA overthrows the government and affects the electoral system, I use the example of the deniability, that whenever somebody's caught, they give great denials about what happened, whereas the evidence doesn't fit those denials. And the Los Angeles Times this week, dated October the 30th, the Monday paper, has a full page, and it's called The Watergate Reviewed, The Allegations and Denials. And if anybody's interested, write the Los Angeles Times for the October 30 issue. And it's by John Lawrence from the Times Washington Bureau. And what they do, they talk about the Watergate affair, how it started. Then they begin with the evidence of who the men were, and they go into the deniability. And then they go into the truth of the background of the particular men. They go into the involvement of John Mitchell, the deniability, then the source of the actual information that caused them to deny in the first place. They go into Bernard Barker's bank accounts, then the deniability, then the source of where the money began to leak from. And this is a full page with many, many sources of actual factual information. It's a marvelous article.
The Times did endorse Nixon.
They did endorse Nixon. Well, you know, there was an article in the Los Angeles Times today, and it was a letters to the editor.
Thursday?
No, it was Thursday's paper. It was a letters to the editor, and it was said, even though the Times endorsed Richard Nixon, the following people are voting for George McGovern, and they printed in the letters to the editor, and it was a long, long list of the Times employees. It was really far out, and they wanted on record that even though the boss was for Richard Nixon, they weren't, and even exposing all of this.
Are those reporters or pressmen or what?
People that work on the staff, maybe set the ink, the typesetters, the reporters, a whole, none of the name reporters that I know, but a whole group of them signed this, you know, and it's really far out. Now, this week's news, I brought in the articles. There was a long two-page article in the Washington Post on the biography of Dwight Chapin, the press secretary, the man who makes all the, not the press, the man who makes all the appointments for Richard Nixon. And it's a two-page article, and it was very revealing for several reasons. Dwight Chapin's father is vice president of Garrett Corporation's aerospace industry. And in my article, when I write about the origins of Richard Nixon, how he's controlled by the aerospace industry, I thought it was interesting that the man who makes all the appointments for Richard Nixon is the son of Norman Spencer Chapin, vice president of Garrett Corporation's. And the father-in-law of Dwight Chapin, the secretary for Richard Nixon, his name is John Howland, and he's with the Santa Barbara Bank of America, one of the California banks bonded by the radicals in 70 and 71. Now, the Isla Vista shootout was provocateurs. Captain Honey Fritz from the L.A. Sheriff's Department came up to that riot. The Santa Barbara law enforcement said they could have handled it. Honey Fritz was removed from office for a while and was under investigation because he had told people if you kill somebody, a student in the building, it's all right, carry two guns. He was alleged to have said to drop it to make it look like two were fleeing. He was involved with a lot of violence Hanif Ritz and Unnecessary Violence up at Isla Vista. And I met a fellow who worked with the sheriff's department and told me about the links of a particular captain under Pitches in Los Angeles who also is connected to the Manson affair. And it gets very interesting to see the relationship of Chapman's father-in-law to that bank in Isla Vista, that Bank of America, because I've been following the links of the Isla Vista to provocateurs to the police state. And the man, U.S. Attorney Robert Meyer, was investigating the Isla Vista provocateur violent situation at the Bank of America when he received a call from Patrick Gray in Washington and said, don't investigate the Isla Vista. So I thought it was interesting this week to learn that Dwight Chapin's father-in-law happens to work at that Bank of America that is involved, where they came down on the students as being violent radicals, and actually it was a provocation again. Washington Post has an article, the Los Angeles Times is putting pressure on the newspaper men Jack Nelson and Ronald Ostrow to get the notes of Alfred Baldwin, who worked at the Watergate. He was at the Howard Johnson Hotel receiving the tapes with the Watergate group, got immunity from arrest for turning evidence on them. There's going to be another fight in the courts. The newsmen are getting pressured to produce their notes, and he won't reproduce them, so that the judges ordered the Times to produce them. The men won't do it, so you're going to see this coming up. There's going to be about 32 files or suits or investigations slated already on the Watergate. I have listed about 22 now at home. Congressional investigations, like one committee in Congress just investigating James McCord, another the funding, this lawsuit now ordering these men from the LA Times to produce. I have a list at home of all the suits, and they're just going to pile up as the months go on. Another interesting article was from the Washington Post, dated October 22nd, and they go into the personalities of the men involved at the Watergate Hotel. So you see, this pile of articles that I have that goes on and on, Phil, is
Not repetitive either. Each one seems to take a different facet of this.
Yeah, see, this one is a brief biography, maybe three or four paragraphs, on Herbert Kalmbach, a new name to people, the president's attorney who's making that deal for that house, you know, that he just got down at the near San Diego. Now, there's Maurice Stans. These are the people that they're writing up, new names that are popping up in the news that make the entourage around Richard Nixon that are involved in the Watergate espionage activities. See, this article is Dwight Chapin, Gordon Strachan, Ken Clausen, William Timmons, Glenn Seedham Jr., Howard Hunt, Robert Mardian, G. Gordon Liddy, James McCord, Fred LaRue, Robert Odle, Hugh Sloan, Herbert Porter, Jeb Magruder. The news is coming in, not with a little AP wire, but two pages of a newspaper. That's a lot of news on one article, isn't it, Phil? That pours in this kind
of... It's very unusual.
It's amazing. And the name of this article in the Washington Post was Charges Involve GOP Figures. Now, in summary, we're running out of time, and I have all these news articles, but what's coming out of all of this, one of the things that's coming out, is that a group of people from the University of Southern California, a group of young people, were active in the politics there. They were a secret society that took over the elections of student body presidents when they were at University of Southern California, and they involved Segretti and Haldeman or Ehrlichman or Ziegler, and a group of young people that worked at the University of Southern California who ruined the electoral process for the student union at the time, who supposedly disrupted through an espionage operation. It seems that they were the training ground or the proving ground for a larger espionage group later, that they used their student activities at the University of Southern California. If some boy was running for student body president, they got five people to oppose, to split the votes, and they stuffed the ballots. They were doing actually illegal, dishonest things, taking down posters as a team at the University of Southern California. Then they all went on to law school, some to Bold Hall, some to UCLA, some to UC. And they went on to law school. Then they went to the J. Walter Thompson Agency, the advertising agency. Ziegler, Haldeman, Ehrlichman took positions and then went on to the White House. And that fits in with the article I did with Richard Nixon on how Richard Nixon really came to power, that he was this clandestine agent.
You did an article with Richard Nixon?
About him, in The Realist, about Nixon. And the article was timely because it came out as the unfolding of the Nixon comes out. And it seems that he is in case, you know, on many shows I talk about Bebe Rebozo as being his sitter outside the White House, and Haldeman covers the White House. And it seems that this team of supposedly young people completely control who makes the appointments, who he sees, what's said to the press. Everyone around him, the communications, is in control of Richard Nixon, and they came from a set group at one particular place into one office onto the White House. And everyone else that affects the electoral process, like a lawyer from California who was in Vietnam, then at Fort Ord goes right to the White House to work with Dwight Chapin and Richard Nixon's lawyer, Kalmbach. You see, those men were all working Maurice Stans in 62 when he was running for governor. So evidently, all the charges that I made based upon my research before this came out, that he was a select agent manipulated by Aerospace and Bank of America since 45, you can see in the news where he's been since 1960, the manipulation, in 56, where Chotiner and that group were all working with him. This team has been working with him all along, and as the evidence of the Watergate comes out, the summary of the articles every day coming out is the connecting links of these teams. Like one of the articles I outlined was that Mr. Chapin takes all of his orders from Haldeman. He's worked with him for quite a few years, 8 or 9, 10 years he's worked for him. And it says he was 31-year-old appointment secretary for the president now. This is from the Washington Post. Has taken orders from Haldeman for 10 years, from the day that Haldeman was his boss at the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency. You're shaking your head, but I'm trying, during the week to outline these things and get the chain of command, and that's, I come to my conclusions from cross-filing this, but this, they're not mincing any words. This one takes orders from that one. This is where they connected. So you get the whole operation of the man who is going to run for president this coming Tuesday. Is that a president, or is that a piece of machinery manipulated by the agency that sold Disneyland and 7-Up? You see, J. Walter Thompson is the agency that handled Richard Nixon all those years. And
well, hope everybody goes to the polls.
I'm not going to tell you who to vote for. Vote for
then
Nixon.
Maybe people can guess.
Vote for Nixon and see if I'm right. I dare you.
That sounds like a challenge. That's about it for a dialogue conspiracy. The mail carries mail to mail. And in a moment, my recorded voice will tell you where to write. We invite you to write. We invite you to approve May wrong, because I'd like to see her work herself out of a job. This has been Dialogue Conspiracy, a public affairs presentation of KLRB News. If you have questions that you want answered on future programs, or any comments, write Dialogue Conspiracy, KLRB, Box 3904, Carmel, California, 93921. I'm Phil Kogan.